Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The New Statesman.
I'm Jeremy Cliff, writer-at-large in Berlin.
I'm Emily Tamkin, senior editor, US, in Washington, D.C.
I'm Ida Volk, Europe correspondent in Berlin.
It's Thursday, the 29th of September. You're listening to World Review from The New Statesman, a twice-weekly international news podcast. Every Monday, we interview a guest for their unique perspective and expertise. Then, later in the week, we come together to unpack some of the most significant stories in world affairs.
Giorgia Meloni is poised to become Italy's next prime minister.
Io sono Giorgia!
I am Giorgia. I am a woman. I am a mother. I am Italian. I am Christian. And you can't take that away from me.
What will that mean for Italy and for Europe?
We also discuss Russia's illegal referendums in eastern Ukraine.
The world will react absolutely justly to pseudo-referendums. They will be definitely condemned, and for the criminal mobilization that the occupiers are currently trying to carry out in Crimea and other parts of the Ukraine, which they still control.
And what might be their consequences?
And we take a listener question on upcoming elections in Brazil. Thank you for joining us. Let's begin. Listeners, your ears have not deceived you. Jeremy is back on the podcast to talk about European elections. Welcome, Jeremy.
Good to be back.
Before we go any further, I do want to plug, for those of you who have not already listened, our colleague Katie's podcast on China and Xi Jinping. First episode is up now. It's available wherever you get your podcasts, and I'm really excited about it. I think it's a super interesting listen. If you were remotely interested in China and in Xi and in his rise, I highly encourage you to take a listen. But now, back to European elections. On Sunday, Italians went to the polls. As expected, the big winner was Giorgia Meloni of the right-wing Brothers of Italy party, which has its roots in, quote, post-fascism, end quote. Many in Italy have insisted the foreign press paid too much attention to the whole fascism thing, and that wasn't really what the election was about. But now that she's won, what can Meloni be expected to usher in for Italy and for Europe more broadly? Jeremy, I just want to quickly start with this one point, because if listeners who listened to the episode that we did with Tim Parks not too long ago, so Tim Parks, for those who didn't listen, is a writer who lives in Italy and who actually voted in this Italian election. And basically his point was that it wasn't really about fascism for voters, and instead it was about sort of feeling disconnected from the governments that have ruled over Italy since they've been appointed and unelected, and sort of a pushback against technocratic elitism, so on and so forth. But I think for those of us not in the thick of it, it's sort of hard to look at anything involving fascism and not say that the fascism is the most important thing. So how do you sort of reconcile that in your mind?
I think, first of all, on the distinction between how this was viewed in Italy and how it was viewed outside Italy, I think it's important to remember that those of us not immersed in Italian politics find the idea of a party with roots in neo-fascism very novel, and I think justly alarming. But for Italians, it's not actually completely new. You know, Meloni, when she was young, was a member of this Italian social movement, which was a sort of predecessor of her party today, Brothers of Italy. And while they were marginal in post-war and sort of Cold War Italian politics, they were not totally taboo. You know, they propped up a Christian Democrat government in the 60s. In the 80s, they were even given a seat on the board of the public broadcaster. And that was the sort of the unreconstructed neo-fascist predecessor of her current party. And then you have one other generation between the Italian Social Movement and Brothers of Italy, which was the National Alliance, which is the party she became part of in the mid-90s. And they were part of all of Silvio Berlusconi's governments from 1994 all the way through to the late 2000s. And so the idea that a party with that heritage can be in power isn't entirely new in Italy. Of course, it is new that that party is now leading a new government. Meloni will almost certainly now become prime minister. Brothers of Italy is by far the largest party in what will be that right-wing governing coalition. But I think it's just not quite as new for Italians. On the point about kind of fascist or not fascist or extreme right or center-right, I think too much of the discourse has been too binary, has assumed that there's one or the other. Either you have kind of soft, cuddly center-right parties, and then you have extreme fascists and Nazis. And the reality in Italy, as elsewhere, is that those categories have become extremely blurred, and not just in Italy. Across Europe, you're seeing conventional Christian Democrat or conservative parties embracing elements of the populist right. You're also seeing extreme parties rebrand themselves, maybe abandon their most extreme positions and make themselves more acceptable. And I think the big story is that the divide between those categories is becoming more and more blurred. And I think you see that in Italy in the fact that, yes, Meloni is the one of the three main right-wing parties to have its roots in Italian fascism, but its policies are not that different from either the Lega, which is one of the other three parties in that broad bloc, or Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia. You know, they're not that far apart. And one of them has roots in fascism, the other two don't. But so blurred has it become that you wouldn't necessarily tell that from their manifestos.
Just to follow up on that, I mean, listening to that, it's not, I can see how someone would say like, oh, there's not much difference between her and the center-right. But the reverse side means that elements of extremism have been so adopted by the center-right that they are now indistinguishable from the far-right.
Yeah. I mean, a case in point is this party, the Lega, which is the party of Matteo Salvini. They did actually quite poorly at this election, but they've been a feature in Italian politics for about three decades. And they started off as a sort of relatively hard-to-place party that was mainly known for campaigning for more autonomy for the wealthier northern regions of Italy. Now, interestingly, I saw a lot of people on social media were promoting a video of Giorgia Meloni talking about a very kind of right-wing conception of the family. And she said, oh, I don't want a version of the family where it's parent one and parent two rather than mother and father. And a lot of people are saying, look, isn't she really, really right-wing? This is a sort of neo-fascist tradition. And of course it is very right-wing and very reactionary. But Matteo Salvini had been making exactly those points during the election campaign. I was at a rally at which all of the main right-wing leaders were speaking in Rome last Thursday, where Salvini literally used that phrase, parent, I don't want parent one, parent two, it's mothers and fathers. So I think it just goes to show that what people are pointing at and saying, look, that's neo-fascism, is also true of other elements of the Italian right, some of which were not conventionally seen as extreme. The key point to come back to my original argument is that the line is more and more blurred.
Absolutely. That video was also incidentally shared by many Republicans in the United States. We can all take from that what we will. Part of what has been missing from this conversation, not our conversation, but the broader conversation about Meloni's victory is that there's been a lot of, oh, this is so concerning and she's going to come in and she's going to be Trump. But it's my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that she won't actually be empowered to do all that much as Italy's new prime minister.
It's true that she has certain restraints. One is maintaining her coalition. There are tensions between her and Salvini, for example. Another is keeping the European institutions broadly on side because Italy is the main beneficiary of the EU's post-COVID recovery fund. It's in line to get about 200 billion euros of support. She's going to have to tackle a cost of living crisis. And that will, of course, take a lot of energy and political capital away from other priorities, like, for example, reactionary social reforms. That said, the policies of both Brothers of Italy and the other parties in that coalition are very reactionary. Meloni in particular pursues this sort of right-wing natalism. I mean, it borders on, and she has evoked the Great Replacement Theory conspiracy, which effectively says that Europeans or native Europeans are being replaced by migrants. Now, I'm not saying that she's going to put that conspiracy wholesale into government practice. She would, I think, given the chance, pursue policies encouraging Italians to have more children, making life yet more difficult for migrants in Italy, for LGBT people, make it more difficult for people to get abortions. Now, the sad truth is that on none of those fronts is Italy particularly progressive as things stand. So it's the most likely thing is that a bad status quo broadly stands still and no progress is made. But I think if she has the time and the capital, she would pursue that. One other thing I would mention on the domestic front, which is worth watching, is Meloni is in favor of a more presidential system, something a bit more like the French political system. And you don't have to look, you know, too hard to find examples of how presidential systems have benefited hard right politicians, whether we're looking at Le Pen coming not too far from winning the French election, or Trump, or indeed Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, who we're going to discuss later in the episode. Now, the right didn't get the 2/3 of the parliamentary seats that it would need to drive through constitutional change, bringing in a presidential system without a referendum, but it can still do it with a referendum. And there have been indications since the election that Meloni would like to pursue that if she gets the chance. So that's something I think worth watching, because that would mean a transformation of the Italian political system that could have very, very big implications.
Often when right-wing leaders come to power in Europe, there's concern that they're going to be sympathetic to Putin. Obviously, given the war in Ukraine, that's particularly concerning. Meloni has sort of tried to position herself as quite supportive of Ukraine, but do you think that her election could have negative consequences for European solidarity and support for Ukraine?
I think there are reasons both to be pessimistic and optimistic. I think on the pessimistic side of things, there is certainly a degree of opportunism to her support for Ukraine. I think for her, it is a bridge to the European institutions and a sort of badge of respectability. And there are elements of her likely soon to be government that are traditionally quite pro-Putin, most obviously Matteo Salvini and the Lega. On the optimistic side, I think her pro-Ukraine stance is also somewhat authentic in that her party and its tradition has long been fairly Atlanticist. And that goes all the way back to the neo-fascist movement during the Cold War, which I think looked to the US because it was very anti-communist. But Meloni has, you know, she's made it clear that she sees herself very much in line with US republicanism on foreign policy. She spoke at CPAC this year. And I think that on foreign policy terms, for example, within the EU, she's definitely closer to Poland's government, which is pretty right-wing and reactionary, but is very hawkish on Russia, than to Hungary's government, which has similar domestic instincts, but is very dovish on Russia, shall we say. I don't see Italy's stance on Ukraine changing particularly, apart from perhaps that she might broadly share the same policy instincts on Ukraine as Mario Draghi, her predecessor, but she is not a leader of his stature in Europe. You know, Draghi could pick up the phone easily to Paris or Brussels or Berlin, and he was quite influential in putting Ukrainian membership of the EU on the agenda. He's been quite a sort of surprisingly strong advocate for Ukraine, particularly as an Italian prime minister. And Italy is a country that has generally tended to the more pro-Putin end of the spectrum within the European Union. And I think even if she takes the same views as him, she obviously won't have the same stature as him in the European institutions. So it might just be that she pursues the same policy, but as it were, less effectively.
Ido, do you have thoughts on what this means for Ukraine?
Jeremy's right when he says that her support is, to a degree, deeply felt. But it's almost kind of irrelevant because there are very material factors for why, even if you oppose sanctions like Salvini does, for example, and you think that these sanctions need to be lifted, and Salvini's been one of the more vocal voices in European politics, becoming increasingly willing to say that sanctions were a bad idea and they should be lifted. That's something that he said during the election campaign. I mean, he's always had this kind of pro-Putin position, but he was really one of the kind of leading figures in European politics, along with like people like Orban and Le Pen, saying that sanctions were a bad idea. But like, that it's simply not possible to lift the sanctions and to reestablish trading relations like they were. This was the case before this week. So, for example, if you were to lift sanctions on businesses doing trade in Russia, some of them would decide to reestablish operations in Russia, but many of them would say, European businesses, but many of them would say, this is just too risky and Russia has shown that it's unreliable and it's an unreliable market, and therefore we're not going to reestablish relations in Russia. So the trade would not go back to what it was on the 23rd of February. And this week we've had an even more visceral demonstration of that with these apparent attacks on the Nord Stream pipelines, where we've had, which I imagine we're going to talk about, but which was critical to underpinning a very large part of Europe's trade relationship with Russia in terms of energy imports, that's been, I mean, it looks like put out of action for a very long time, if not permanently. I mean, literally, even if we wanted to turn back on the gas, we just can't now, at least through this pipeline. So whether a particular government or particular party or whatever is sympathetic to Russia, it's almost irrelevant because there are very sort of material constraints on how far those countries and those parties can put those policies into effect.
Well, we will continue to watch Meloni's, I mean, likely first days as prime minister, the referendum Jarvie's mentioned, and more. But for now, we are going to turn to our second subject, which is not unrelated. Russia carried out 4 illegal referendums on annexation in Ukraine, all of which it claims passed with over 90% of the vote. Again, it's not like a legitimate number. Putin intimated before these referendums were held that Russia, after annexing Ukrainian territory, could claim that an attack on it would fall under Russia's nuclear umbrella. Dmitry Medvedev, the former Russian president who, a little over a decade ago, winked at being a liberal, made this point more explicitly. So now that, right, like the referendums have been held, they're claiming that these territories are now Russia. I guess Ido and I were speaking about this earlier this week, and my take was sort of that this doesn't actually change anything in that the territory, like I could say that I'm the queen of Berlin, right? And like, I don't actually control Berlin. And it doesn't actually change the fighting on the ground. Like Russia doesn't occupy all of this territory, even militarily. So I don't know what declaring that it does in effect, unless it changes everything and they decide that they actually are going to go for this and say, well, you attacked what I'm claiming is my territory and thus I'm going to use nuclear weapons. But Jeremy, Ido, what do you think? Ido, let's start with you.
The way I see it is that this is Putin kind of setting out what he wants, setting out the kind of contours of some kind of settlement. There are lots of signals that Putin is trying to signal that he's in this for the long term when it looked like Russia was losing militarily on the battlefield. So you can see this. You can see this with these so-called votes. You can see this with the announcement of a national conscription drive, which is going to recruit hundreds of thousands, perhaps up to 1 million men to join the Russian armed forces. And you can see it in the nuclear threats. And it seems like Putin knows that Russia is losing on the battlefield and that he can see the kind of contours of a ceasefire or a peace deal, which is that Russia holds the territory that it already has and comes to some sort of settlement because the West is scared of nuclear war, Europe is scared of cold winter, the Ukrainians are being pressured by, you know, the Germans or whatever to settle. And the Ukrainians and the Russians come to this agreement where Putin holds this land bridge to Crimea and the eastern regions of Luhansk and Donetsk. That's at least how I see it. I don't really think that the second that Putin says that Luhansk and Donetsk and Zaporizhia and Kherson are part of the Russian Federation, then the fact that large parts of Russia, as I'm doing air quotes there, you can't see it on the podcast, but I am, that large parts of Russia are occupied, air quotes again, by a foreign country, that suddenly that means that Russia will use nuclear weapons. Russia is a big fan of these kind of elaborate legal fictions. So it's an aside, but these referendums that they're having in Zaporizhia and in Kherson, the ballot papers say, are you in favor of Kherson and Zaporizhia leaving Ukraine, becoming independent states, and then acceding to Russia? So they have to have this sort of elaborate legal reasoning where the countries, where the regions become independent countries and then join Russia, which is, according to the Russian legal reasoning, is what happened in Crimea in 2014, and they're doing the same thing, and in Donetsk and Luhansk too. So they're fans of these kind of elaborate legal fictions, but I really don't think that if the end game was to nuke Ukraine or you know, NATO or whatever, I don't think that they would need to go through with these kind of elaborate fictions. I think it's more about setting out the contours of a deal and signaling that they're not about to back down and for the West to kind of take them off on their bluff or not.
Jeremy,
I think it can't be stressed enough how fantastical these supposed referenda are. And I think some voices in the West that should know better have not been emphasizing that point sufficiently. I've seen a few news agencies reporting the results of the referenda the non-referenda, and then saying, well, and Ukraine disputes the validity of these results, with sort of classic both sides-ism. And likewise, in the German press recently, there's been a sort of a strong seam, including actually from figures who are not conventionally dovish towards Putin, of, oh, well, once these parts of Ukraine have been taken into Russia, what do we do then? Effectively taking this fiction at face value. And I think it can't be said often enough that Putin can come up with any number of nonsense claims. He can say, you know, he might want to decide tomorrow that Estonia is actually part of Russia, or maybe Eastern Poland, or maybe Moldova. It's still total nonsense. And I just think that, you know, you can't let the Russian fictions reframe the reality, which is that these places are Ukraine, and him saying otherwise with some act of theatre of a referendum changes anything. And I think, you know, it's worth sort of stressing, particularly among those in the West who inclined to think that it does change something fundamental, that at the end of the day, if Putin is mad enough to want to use nuclear force, then he'll do that, whether or not there's some grand story about why he's doing so as a justification. And I just think it's important for the West to keep its eye on the fundamentals, which are that this is Ukraine, that Putin is an unpredictable leader whose state of mind it is hard to judge, and that the key thing is just to maintain support for Ukraine and deter any escalation on his part.
I saw a tweet, I think from a Lithuanian MP, that said that the people of the historic Lithuanian lands of Smolensk have decided that it's now Lithuania. So, like, what, I mean, what are
we? I think that's the right sort of response.
Anyway, Ido, there was other particularly notable news this week regarding Nord Stream, 1 and 2. Do you want to quickly tell our listeners about what happened there and what might happen next?
This week on Monday, the two Nord Stream pipelines, 1 and 2, which run from Russia to Germany through the Baltic Sea, began spewing natural gas into the sea. And this was apparently the result of several quite large explosions close to the pipelines, which were recorded by seismologists in Sweden and Norway. Denmark and Germany and Sweden have quickly said that they probably think that this was the result of sabotage, so deliberate actions. That seems very, very likely, because these are pipelines which are built from steel, which is 4 centimeters thick, coated with reinforced concrete, 11 centimeters thick. So it's hard to imagine that it could leak in 3 different places simultaneously, because leaks in undersea pipelines are pretty rare. Obviously, it's very hard to attribute blame for these explosions, but lots of countries have immediately pointed the finger to Russia. So Poland and Ukraine in particular. And then there's some slightly more esoteric reasoning. So the German newspaper, the Tagesspiegel, speculated that Ukrainian-related forces could be responsible. More power to them. And most amusingly, I think, was the former Polish Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski, who captioned a photo of the leak with, quote, "Thank you, USA." So we might never know who's responsible.
Just really want to stress that it is not the position of this podcast that the United States sabotaged these pipelines.
Can we definitively say that it wasn't, though? But if, as lots of countries have reasoned, Russia was responsible for the attacks, the rationale probably went something like this. So Russia was permanently losing its leverage over the EU because the EU was rapidly becoming energy independent of Russia and was looking pretty confident they was going to be able to get through the winter without too much difficulty without Russian energy, despite a lot of kind of fear that the winter would be very difficult because Russia had shut off the gas. It's trying to turn this leverage into an advantage by demonstrating its ability to hit these essentials components of Europe's energy infrastructure. So this pipeline, obviously, because the EU's strategy to wean itself off Russian energy relies on increased imports from alternative suppliers like Norway and Algeria, including many by undersea pipeline, then this really shows that that infrastructure is vulnerable. And it's not only that infrastructure, it's also, for example, undersea communications cables, which typically do not have as much protection as a gas pipeline. So yeah, it's quite difficult to ascribe blame, but what you can say is that this does kind of highlight the vulnerability of a lot of Europe's critical infrastructure, including that which the EU's winter energy plan relies on.
Ido has written a piece on this that we will put in the show notes to this episode, and Jeremy has also written on our first segment on Meloni and the Italian elections. We will put those links in the show notes as well.
Wherever you are in the world,
if you're interested in global affairs,
you can subscribe to The New Statesman in digital, in print, or both from as little as £1 a week. That's 12 weeks for just £12.
That's €1 a week in Europe and just $2 a week in America.
Just go to www.newstatesman.com/podcast offer.
From The New Statesman comes a new podcast, Audio Long Reads, the best of our reported features and essays, read aloud. Featuring writing from our authors, including the historian Colin Kidd on Watergate's renewed relevance in a post-Trump era.
Today's obsessions about a deep state took their rise in the 70s amid this climate of anxiety.
Jeff Dyer's reflections on how to grow old in America.
He was propped up in bed, proudly sporting a badge. Private medicine makes me sick.
Maria Vilcek tells the story of how the hard men of Belarusian football took on Alexander Lukashenko.
Hundreds of ultras were roughed up and held in custody. One was later found dead in suspicious circumstances.
Ease into the weekend with our audio long reads, published every Saturday morning. Just search Audio Long Reads from The New Statesman, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's time to move to a section that we like to call
You Ask Us.
Thanks, Jeremy. Ito. Just kidding. Well, I'm not. But anyway, our listener question this week is, well, will Bolsonaro concede? So this is a question about the outcome of the upcoming Brazilian elections. If current Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro does not win, will he concede for the good of his country and democracy? Or will he follow the model of his neighbors to the north and insist that actually he won? Jeremy, what do you think?
Brazil goes to the polls this Sunday, the 2nd of October, in the first round of its election. It will be the first of two, assuming that no candidate takes more than 50%, which currently looks likely. The former president from 2003 to 2010, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, is leading on around 43% to 48%, depending on which poll you believe. And that gives him an advantage of about 6 to 14 points over the sitting president, the far-right Jair Bolsonaro. Now, Bolsonaro has been making comments that will be familiar to students of the run-up to and aftermath of the last American presidential election. He's been casting doubt on the electronic voting system that Brazil uses. He said effectively that if he loses, it means that fraud has been committed. He does not foresee a possibility that Lula could win legitimately. He's used violent language. He's talked about machine gunning supporters of Lula. And most notably, he said that he sees one of three outcomes of the election, that he ends up in prison, that he wins or ends up dead. So I think we can conclude from that and from his record as president that if he gets the chance to contest or to challenge or to upset the election result, he will take it. And the question is more, does he see that chance? And do those who are inclined to support him see that chance there? Brazil's democracy, it is probably fair to say, is less firmly established than America's. It's only been a democracy. It had a military dictatorship until 1985. The military is more politicized there, and parts of it are somewhat close to Bolsonaro. His running mate, for example, is a former general. And the view among Brazilian political analysts seems to be that where the chances of Bolsonaro seeing the opportunity to overturn the election result depend on the size of Lula's victory. If it is so vast as to be uncontestable, even by someone as extreme as Bolsonaro, then it's less likely. If it is much closer, then there is a chance that he stirs up his supporters to come onto the streets to commit acts of violence, giving the pretext then to bring in the army to quote unquote restore order, and then possibly invoke emergency powers. So, long story short, the bigger the lead that Lula gets, the smaller the chance that Bolsonaro tries to put Brazil's democratic institutions to the test.
Well, we will be watching that one with trepidation this weekend. And for now, Ido, will you please get us out of here?
Thanks to all of you who sent in your questions. You can send yours in at podcasts@newstatesman.co.uk or by tweeting at us. That's all the time we have for today. Join us on Monday for our interview episode with David Broder, a historian of fascism in Italy, past and present.
If you are a regular World Review listener and you haven't already subscribed, please subscribe. And if you've already subscribed, thank you so much. It really helps. Please also rate us 5 stars and leave us a nice review. That really helps too. Our producer has been Mae Robson. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.